and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by a couple of gals who are very excited for our guests today. But anyways, we're your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. Today is actually our first time to ever have a two-part series. So our guests are very excited about that, I am sure. Maybe not, but they'll keep that to themselves.
This was their idea, man.
That's right. Again, just remember that you guys suggested it. So part one will be about review and analysis. We're continuing along the EDRM and that long and winding road. So we'll be talking about review analysis today, the business end. And then this is like a mullet. It's like business in the front and then party in the back. So part two will be more of the happy hour party version, if there could ever be one that involves a review and analysis. So that's our goal for today. But before I talk, I think we should probably introduce our guests. What do you think, Angie?
Oh, I think that's a great idea. So our guests today are Christy McGowan and Brenda Dodd. Christy is the Director of Legal Operations at Extero, an e-discovery service provider. She's also been an adjunct professor at UC Irvine. And before that, she was Director of Infrastructure at SIFT Discovery. And as if that were not enough, she has also been the chair of the Law Practice Management Technology section at the California Lawyers Association. And she's also founded her own e-discovery company, e-discovery litigation specialists. Brenda is the director of product management at Extero. She is an innovative certified e-discovery specialist with over 30 years of experience in the legal industry. Brenda is passionate about creating solutions that address complex challenges. She leverages her unique combination of legal and technical experience and has helped law firms, corporations, and government entities successfully implement technology for cost-effective and efficient management of review of electronically stored information. So without,
oh my gosh.
I know, right? That was a tongue twister.
Woo!
Without further ado, welcome Christy. Welcome Brenda. We are thrilled to have you and we can't wait to chat review with both of you.
Glad to be here.
I have a little icebreaker question for you just so we can start off on a fun note. We don't want to drag everybody down immediately.
Some of us like doc review.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a special breed of someone that likes a doc review. Okay, so icebreaker. If you weren't doing this for a living, and I know how fulfilling your careers are and that you would never want to leave, but if you had to and you had to choose something else to do, how would you spend your time?
So actually, document review is the reason why I got into technology in the first place, because I knew that there was always a better and easier, more efficient way to do it first off. So no one liked document review. But if I weren't doing this, I would definitely want to be a chef because I love to cook. I especially love to cook for people. It just brings so much joy to see someone enjoying the things that I've made for them. So I would definitely be a chef. Although Christy and I have a side plan for when things go south or when we want to retire. I'll let Christy tell you what that plan is.
Wait a second. When things go south.
All right, Christy, what are you going to do?
I'm on that train, folks.
Oh, Brenda and I are starting a popsicle stand on the beach in Florida.
That sounds fantastic. Are they going to be alcohol popsicles or regular ones?
Yes, definitely alcohol.
Here's one for the kids and here's one for the adults.
Right. I love that. As a parent whose child requests popsicles for breakfast every single day, I would frequent your popsicle stand.
Wait, if that doesn't come to fruition, I guess my goal when I was little is I wanted to work for the FBI. I wanted to do computer forensics for as long as I could remember.
Wow, so that's what I
would have worked for the FBI in some capacity.
Wow.
Oh my God. And we'd all be terrified of you.
Oh, I wouldn't want you digging in my stuff.
You can dig around in mine. It's mostly cat photos.
Brenda, so putting your two passions together of being a chef and a popsicle stand owner, do you have like a signature popsicle that you would create?
Great question. It would have to be. See, I'm not into the sweet, so I'm more on the salty side. So it probably have to be like something like a margarita, like a Corona and a margarita with a little bit of salt kind of flavor popsicle, I think.
Like some tahini on there too, maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably refreshing for the beach, right?
That sounds good. So that would be the Brenda. What would be the Christy signature popsicle?
I'm the opposite. I'm the sweet. Strawberry, melon, something like that. Like a little strawberry margarita popsicle.
Delish. Yeah. I want something with like probably like some vodka and basil and cucumber or something like that. Like that would be my
nice
jam.
Refreshing, yeah.
I think I would want Andy's a spicy, like, spicy marg.
Yeah,
oh, a spicy margarita. Yeah, that'd be good too.
I think that sounds good. I want some heat. I want the popsicle to kind of hurt. You know.
Wow.
Okay, so review. Okay, so we are so excited to talk to you both about review. I know that you've been in this field for ever and you have a wealth of knowledge. And so let's dive in. My first question is for you, Brenda. So review and analysis is known as the most expensive portion of the EDRM lifecycle. Can you tell me why that is?
Andy, that's so true. So what do they say? 70 to 80% of the costs are directly associated to the review side of things. The reason for that is really just the amount of data that we're facing today, right? Think of all the different data sources that now are available that we have to collect from. The more data, of course, means more documents to review. Not just the amount of data, but the various types of data also, right? Think about from when I started doing this 30 years ago, it was basically paper. But now we're talking mobile data and communication type data from Slack and Teams to audio video type content that just is, it takes a lot more time to review and analyze. So I think that the data types and just the sheer amount of data is one of the leading reasons why review is so costly. Because of that, we also have to have, you know, different types of resources, different types of technology to be able to review all that data, put that data in context, right? Anyone could go out and collect Slack and Teams, but if we're not presenting that in some contextual way for the reviewers to actually review it, it just means more time, right? That they're looking at the data to piece it all together. So I think that those are really the two key areas that I think are the reason why we see so much expense related to the review side of things.
Yeah, you were mentioning paper. That brought back a lot of memories for me because samesies, when I first got started, it was all paper and post-it notes and, you know, manual Bates labels and the whole nine. But really, eDiscovery has grown so much over the years. And it's been really exciting, I think, personally, to see how far eDiscovery has come. So, Christy, I have a question for you. What are some other areas or industries that you could see that could actually utilize the eDiscovery technology that we use in review and analysis? How would it help other areas?
Records request, privacy, DSAR, cyber breach, internal investigations is another, which is a little bit different than, you know, full-blown litigation, but you still have to get to the core set of data to start your analysis. So Brenda, anything else that you could think of just different areas? It really, it has evolved. I do work with a lot of clients now that are using review products for DSAR, right? Just straight DSAR and public records request. Once they set the protocol, then they can start, you know, they basically pass that to their teams to review in the platform. And that is just consistent throughout every single DSAR review.
Yeah, I agree with Christy. Like we're talking data and data ultimately, regardless if you're responding to a litigation request, a subpoena request, or doing an internal investigation, right? That data ultimately needs to be reviewed. Probably more so now than in the past due to a lot of the privacy concerns that we're left to address now, which, you know, 30 years ago when I started in this business, reviewing documents and specifically with an eye towards someone's privacy, it wasn't really on the agenda, right? We didn't really take into consideration the privacy concerns that we have now. And I think because of those, it's complicated our review, which goes back to your first question, Angie, why is review so expensive? Because as technology and things involve privacy has also evolved. We've seen a change, but these are all things that the tools that we use for review and having the process in place for review kind of help us put the pieces together.
Yeah, I want to touch on that real quick. When you're working in a review product, you know, hopefully you have a review product that pretty much encompasses everything that you need for a review project. But when you think of privacy or breach, those are just little components. When people are reviewing in these platforms, they really do have the tools that they need to be able to do these sorts of targeted type internal investigation or cyber breach or DSAR reviews.
That's one reason why I find this a very exciting time in eDiscovery, because we'll have people listening to even our podcast who may not be involved with a review and analysis on a day-to-day basis as it relates to litigation or subpoenas or internal investigations, but perhaps they're in a privacy department somewhere trying to figure out how to handle that DSAR that came in. So I think it's nice to know that what we're learning and what we're exploring and all of the years that we put into it can actually help in so many different ways.
To your point, to all of your points, really, the breadth of review and analysis and the areas of business and commerce that this touches on are just really, really vast. Because we have so much data now, because this is so labor intensive, and because it's so costly, having a good foundation is really key to a successful review project. Brenda, what makes a solid foundation? How can you set yourself up for success when you're starting a project?
To me, it always comes back to something that I refer to as the three P's, right? I think that you have to have the right people, the right process, and the right product. And by product, I mean the right technology to address the review process.
Yeah, but three P's sounds better. So
yeah,
let's stick with the P. Yeah.
Process, product, right? We didn't really ask the question, why do we do review in the first place? Well, it depends on what are you faced with. Is it a litigation? Is it a records request? Is it a DSAR, as Christy was talking about? It's really all about analyzing the information and identifying documents that are either relevant or responsive to the matter at hand. To be able to achieve that, you have to have the three P's, right? The right people, the people that are knowledgeable or could be trained into efficiently doing the review. But to not have the right process in place, right? You're not going to be efficient. I look at it as a whole process from start to finish, not just about the review, all the way from legal hold through collection, the entire EDRM, which you ladies are talking about, right? As far as a process for review, and I think we're going to get into this a little bit later, it's really talking about knowing exactly what you're looking for in this process, in this review, right? What is considered a responsive document? What is considered a privileged document? How is this going to be QC'd? Things of that nature. That's what I talk about with process. And of course, the product or the technology, making sure that technology is going to fit the needs of what you need to accomplish.
I like the three P's. I think that's a good framework for us to kind of have a little conversation here this afternoon. Power to the P's.
Yeah, power to the P's. And I think we could throw one more P in there. I think you could treat review like a project, right? So having a project manager and, you know, treating it like a project is very important. So three P's plus a project manager.
So if we were playing a drinking game, every time that somebody said a word that starts with the letter P, drink. So we'll start with first P, the people. So when we're talking about setting up a review and analysis workflow or project, who are the people that are typically involved?
You really are dealing with definitely you're going to have different teams, right? But usually when you have a review that's going to take place, what we traditionally see is those teams are generally managed by a vendor. An outside vendor comes in and has their own review team. Or you have a review team that's coming in from the law firm, but the vendor is managing the project, right? So let's just take the review team as it's managed by a vendor. Right. So you're going to have a review team. You're going to have a project manager. You're going to have a litigation support admin. You're going to have reviewers. That's pretty much your core team of people. Your PM, your project manager. Well, you're going to have a QC team, but that QC team is usually wrapped up with the reviewers. They'll usually take two of the reviewers and say, you're the QC team. Right. You've done the first pass review. We're going to take you and we're going to put you on a QC team. The PM is going to be that top level person. They have to definitely have a skill set to be able to communicate with the entire team on all levels. You know, if a partner is asking what the status is, if they have to communicate with an associate, if they have to communicate with a litigation support admin at the firm, the communication to those parties is super critical. So that PM is going to be your point of contact. One thing we didn't really talk about, a privilege log. What team is going to come in and kind of do that QC of the privilege documents as well? So you have multiple layers of reviewers that are going to go from straight first pass to second pass to QC to your priv review, possibly a production team. Let's make sure everything is QC'd before it goes out the door.
I want to add to that too. So, I mean, that's from a managed review, large scale litigation review. What about the internal reviews? I still think it comes down to the right people, right? And by people, we mean the folks that are most knowledgeable that can quickly analyze and determine what information is relevant or potentially responsive to the requests. Hand.
You make a good point. You know, reviews really kind of depend on what's being reviewed, the scope of what's being reviewed in terms of who's going to be involved. And you're right, Brenda, sometimes it's a small team and You're right, Christy. Sometimes it's a big team. So we talk about this concept of meet and confer when we talk about litigation, and everybody hates that phrase probably. But I always think about it in this step of like putting together all the people and how important it is to have open communication. Why would you guys say that this is important from your standpoint, and how does this work?
Oh, I love that question because, yeah, so meet and confer is, you know, something that the parties typically do, but I agree that it shouldn't just take place between the parties. The internal legal teams and their internal customers, so to say, so the departments should be meeting and conferring, right, to determine what is this case all about? Do we even have a case? Should we consider settling? Who are the cast of characters? So for me, a large portion of my background came from managing internal e-discovery in corporations, and my meet and confers were really about that stuff, the internal meet and confer, so that we could get a handle on what is this case all about? What needs do we have? What resources do we need? How much data are we talking about? Things of that nature. So to me, the meet and confer, which from a review perspective is one thing, but I always looked at the meet and confer as something internally that should be done on every review or collection to kind of get the internal team on the same page.
Yeah. And when I worked at a law firm and I was the one that was really putting these together internally, and we would have after the official meet and confer, we would have one internally because I did have to decide on staffing. How are my paralegals staffed right now? What associates are staffed? You know, what's coming in? What is the size of the data? Are they collecting 50 custodians? Or are they collecting two? If you see this long list of custodians, you could probably assume that the data volume is going to be a pretty decent size and you need to staff it appropriately. For us, I would always ask those questions to the attorney once they got back from the meet and confer. And, you know, I just had my list of questions, which would really prompt me to have that internal meet and confer.
Christy, would you also have those same types of, let's call them meet and confers? I think they should occur between the law firm and their customers as well, right? I wouldn't want my attorneys going to a meet and confer without conferring with me first.
Can I like add a major plus one to that statement?
Yeah.
You see these horror cases, attorneys going to meet and confers and committing their clients to do something, to produce some data, to produce it in a certain way without getting the client's buy-in. And then they go back to the client and the client's like, that's impossible, or I can't do that. So you see lawyers getting their clients into trouble doing this quite often.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And we had a client questionnaire that would actually go out before the meet and confer, where we asked them 5 pages of questions, right? All things we would have to talk about during the meet.
Yeah.
As you should.
That's a fantastic process to have in place. And speaking of processes, that is our second P today. So I want to, everyone drink. So I want to turn to that. And I want to start with our review protocol part of the process. So what is a review protocol and why are they so critical?
Think of it kind of like a memorandum, a review memorandum. The memorandum is going to lay out your review.
Well, and Christy, you make an important point there, though, that these can be, like, it could go by a different name. It could be a review memo, could be a process memo, like whatever your team calls it. We're just referring to it as a review protocol in this conversation as a shorthand for all those things.
It is important because you want to set your reviewers up for success. You want to standardize the process. You want everyone to look at the tagging or the layouts or the review, you know, as they're going through the review, and have a document to always go back to. If they have a question, if they're stuck on something, how should I tag this? This is the issue that I'm looking at right now. Based on the protocol, it says to lean towards this way of tagging the document. So it allows that the reviewers, the consistency in review. You're not left with the reviewers guessing.
So what kinds of things would you include in one of these review protocols?
Oh, I am glad you asked, Angie.
Uh-oh. Put your seatbelts on, ladies and gentlemen.
Buckle it.
The review protocols that we used to put together, they're anywhere from about 9 to 12 pages. with a factual background about the case. What is it about? Who are the parties? Because you got to make sure the reviewers don't have conflicts. Your summary of the pleadings, which also includes where is discovery at in the process? Are there depositions? Are we getting ready for depositions? The responsiveness determinations. It's going to go through each tag and it's going to say, this label means this. If you tag X, you must tag Y. So it goes through those responsiveness determinations. You also have an end-to-end workflow that is built into that, which is, will you be reviewing the entire thread only? Or are you going to be reviewing all documents in that thread? Will you be producing the most inclusive thread only? Will you produce non-responsive families to the responsive parent email? And then it goes through a production protocol, you know, the production guidelines. Mm-hmm. And then it goes through QC determination. So that kind of builds your protocol.
And I just want to plug how critical it is to have one of these in place. When I was back at the law firm, I remember one project that we had that was millions of documents, literally. And so I drafted a review protocol for us, and we could plug people into that review as needed because they could just read the review protocol and be like, okay, here's how we're doing this. And it was super important because it was a fairly niche area of construction law. And so we had all these really unique labels that people wouldn't come across that often. And so we had to define what they meant for people who were not up to their eyes in this case. But it was so critical for that. Like if you're tagging roof, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean the membrane under the shingles? Does it mean just the shingles? Does it mean, you know, the waterproofing, you know, whatever it was. And so we had all these things defined and it was essential to our success in that project.
And you got to think that your reviewers probably really appreciated that.
Their first thought was probably, ugh. And then their second thought was, well, at least there's a protocol to follow. We were preparing for an arbitration. And so every day we would be like, okay, let's pull the documents that are tagged with this thing and like, let's review them. Or we need support for this motion. Let's go pull things that are tagged with this tag and review them. And so it's super critical to your success, not only in the review project, but to your litigation in general.
I always looked at it as, you know, the protocol actually puts the bumper rails for the review team, right? So they never go in the gutter. Their minds are never straying. They're always kind of kept, hopefully, on the straight and narrow. Now we know review is not something that's easily done because it's not a fun job. But having that protocol, I used to call it the project Bible because, you know, this was gospel, right? This is what you had to do in this review. And if you ever had questions, you know where to go and find them. So it is absolutely essential to have some form of protocol in place that's going to keep those reviewers within the lane.
Now, are you going to want one of these for every review project or just some? How do you make that decision?
You know, we had a client that, you know, would have 5,000 documents and we had a review protocol and it would just be much more watered down. It really is going to depend on the client. But if you have reviewers, in my opinion, you should have a protocol. That should be the basis for, do I have a protocol or not? It doesn't have to be this detailed, but you should have one if you've got reviewers.
I agree. And maybe not from a law firm perspective, but think from a corporate perspective. Let's not call it a review protocol. Let's call it a e-discovery protocol or guidelines, right? So even if they're just responding to subpoenas, they do it in the same way every single time. Because what does that do? It creates a defensible process.
Yeah. It's a playbook. It's a, yep. Yeah.
Exactly.
So who writes these?
It's usually going to be a senior level associate. Usually the partners aren't writing them, but whoever is closest to the case, it could be a paralegal litigation support. It's who has the most knowledge of the case. Usually you want the person that's going to be in trial or doing the depots to be involved in that process.
It's kind of for that same reason I just mentioned. The person who's closest to the case knows how these documents are going to be used strategically. So if you know, for example, that you're going to go hammered on this one issue. You know, you're just going to drill that in every witness that you possibly can. Well, you're probably going to want a lot of different labels that go with that issue, or at least one, and you want to make sure that your reviewers know how to deploy it. We've kind of touched on the importance of consistency, but can you explain why it's so important for all people involved in a review project to have consistency when they're reviewing?
Well, that way you don't have a lot of QC overturn. That's not the only reason. Well, the reason you want the consistency is so that labels are being applied correctly. It's really communication, Angie. Communication is the driver here.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have consistency with communication. As long as your team is communicating and they're communicating effectively, that is where you are going to see the best outcome in a review project. That you have a PM that is communicating and how those things are even going to be set up. Kind of what Brenda first talked about, the three P's. And this is part of the product, because things like, you know, what product is going to be used for communication? Are you going to set up a Slack or a Teams channel for the reviewers to be working with the PM, which is what we did, by the way. For every new matter, we actually had a Slack channel for that project. And that's where reviewers can post questions, right? Because that way the whole team can see what the answer is, because maybe they've come across it. Or when they do come across that again, they're able to go, oh, I remember that I should lean this way when I'm seeing this sort of issue.
I think consistency is going to hopefully alleviate or prevent the risk of inadvertent disclosures, right? So you're hoping that all of your reviewers are consistently labeling documents accurately, because you're counting on them to make those decisions ultimately to produce documents, right? Mm-hmm. And if they're not consistently reviewing and applying the labels or coding the documents in a consistent manner, then that puts a major risk on your shoulder of inadvertently disclosing something that you shouldn't have done.
Yeah.
I wanted to throw something in too, just, you know, because everybody else is, and I don't want to be left out.
Because I have FOMO.
In the communication part of it, I think that it's so important to keep that communication active. And I loved hearing your ideas on that, Christy. The review protocol is very specific, but the things that fall outside of the review protocol are often the things that get missed. You know, the motive, the intent, the things that attorneys are really trying to find, but they don't know what it looks like until it's seen. The team doesn't know to alert an attorney, hey, I just saw something that's out of the box. I just saw something we didn't define in our protocol. But it seems like it's super important, because we've been in constant communication with one another, and I know exactly what you're trying to find. What do you think about this? I think that communication cannot be more important.
Bree, absolutely correct. And frankly, that's where a protocol can change as well. Someone might find an issue that not even the attorney knew existed.
Yeah.
And that could change the review and basically even where it's going, right? Mm-hmm. That what if this big red flag just came out that, oh my gosh, a bunch of people knew this issue. And now that attorney's mind now has to shift to, okay, you guys are going to focus on this issue, and now the rest of you are going to continue on your review. And that's where, you know, you hope your reviewers are well-versed enough to kind of address an issue like that comes up.
Okay, so we've covered review protocol, but that is not the only sub-P protocol to our process.
Seriously. I didn't think about the P drinking game, but now that I realize that protocol also starts with a P.
Do you have to pee yet?
Because no, we're going to have to hurry this along. What is ESI protocol? What does that mean?
The ESI protocol, it really is an agreement between the parties, right, that kind of sets the foundation of how electronically stored information is going to be handled during the pendency of the litigation, right? Think of it as, I'll give you another P word, a prenuptial agreement for the litigation department, right? They're going to decide exactly what is going to happen during this proceeding. Everything from this is what we are collecting to how we're going to collect it, to how we're going to process it, to how we're going to produce it. Boy, that was another P. So it really is like, it sets the foundation between the parties on, you know, how electronically stored information is going to be handled during the pendency of the litigation.
Do we have to have an ESI protocol for every single case, every single review?
Some courts require them, actually, yes. Do I think they're advisable? That absolutely. I think every single case should have one, because as I said, it sets the foundation. It keeps you on the straight and narrow. It also gives you the ability to argue when the opposing side doesn't do what they said they were going to do, right? So you can look for some relief that they're not. So in my opinion, ESI protocols are very important and should be entered between the parties on every single case. Now, maybe some smaller cases, you know, where the parties can work things out, then maybe not as such. But I really think that they're a key benefit. Think of from a plaintiff's perspective, where they may not be as savvy in e-discovery, or they may not think that they need one because they don't really have any data, right? They don't have any ESI that they're going to collect and produce. Having an ESI protocol in place, though, is going to protect them from the other side, right? The big corporations that have all of the ESI. That ESI protocol is really imperative for those smaller, you know, plaintiffs parties, in my opinion.
And I 100% agree. I work with clients that they're like, oh, I've got this really small case. And then after discovery starts, oh my gosh, it's turning into a really big case. We don't have a protocol now. Whoopsie. And they just start producing PDFs. Then the question is, well, how do I find who authored the document? And I'm like, oh, you can't. How do I find this information? You can't. You didn't have a protocol. You've got PDFs, mm-hmm. right? That's why it's important, because even if it's a small case now, it could turn into a larger case.
That's a great point. And there are other protocols, P word, out there that we do have to consider too. And not just our own ESI protocol that we might be drafting with between the parties, right? So Brenda, can you give us some examples of what those other protocols might be?
Well, I can think of something that you'd probably want to add to your protocols, especially the ESI protocol, and that would be a clawback agreement. I talked about inadvertent disclosure when your reviewers are not consistently reviewing and you unfortunately produce something that you shouldn't have. That clawback agreement is going to give you the ability to say, hey, hold on a second, I want that document back. And protect yourself. So I think that's a really important protocol, not so much a protocol, but something to add to your arsenal.
And for those of you who are out there like, what in the heck is ESI protocol? I've never heard of this before. I don't even know what this is all about. There's some other types of protocols purposely using the keywords that are out there. Sometimes we have to follow protocols that the court has established. The judge has already said, hey, in my courtroom, this is how you're going to do things. And they've already said ahead of time. There's also standards out there, like DOJ has standards that oftentimes parties will follow if they don't have ESI protocols out there. So anyway, you can Google all that in your spare time when you're feeling lonely and you miss the e-discovery checks.
I do want to add something else. Dealing with the data sizes that we deal with, structured data should absolutely be a clause in any e-discovery or ESI protocol order. How are you going to collect it? How are we going to review it? If someone is sending you, you know, a 10 gigabyte CSV file, you're never going to open it. That is structured data. How is that going to be handled? How is it going to be reviewed? So that should be a clause in your orders, because keep in mind, when we are dealing with ESI protocols 10 years ago, the landscape has changed. The volumes are bigger. The data is bigger. We're dealing with structured data now. That's not just like, here's your emails, here's your Word documents, here's your Excel files. We are dealing with large volumes of data. We're dealing with Salesforce. We're dealing with things of a larger magnitude. So you should just think of those things that should be included in your protocol, right? What types of discovery are you dealing
with? That's a great point. And I want to turn us to something that's going to inform how we think about all of this, all of our protocols and all of our processes and our goals. And that is early case assessment, or ECA. We've referred to ECAs in earlier episodes and kind of briefly touched on it. But can you explain to our listeners, what is an ECA and how can it affect the review project?
What ECA really means, it's early culling of the data. Right? It's your data has been processed. How do I get that data pulled down? And when I say processed, it's really collected, right? How do we narrow the scope before collection? Whether that be a date filter, whether that be we're not going to extract embedded objects or logos, whether that be we're only collecting from certain custodians. That is really the process of ECA. You're taking the data and you're making decisions on how are we going to narrow the scope.
By doing ECA, it's given you that more detailed insight into what is potentially be collected or analyzed, right? And determining, you know, allowing you to make earlier decisions as to whether or not you should even bother collecting, because maybe there was that smoking gun that Angie found that we probably should have found earlier and not even pursued, you know, a defense of this litigation. So I think ECA is all-encompassing of a lot of different things, from, you know, narrowing the scope of documents, because by narrowing the scope, you're ultimately going to reduce the review cost, right? The less you collect, the less you have to review, and therefore the less money you're spending on review. But I think it goes even broader, because as Christy said, it allows you to make better decisions about the matter at hand and who are the key players and what are the key issues and do we even have a defense or do we have an action to pursue? So I think ECA, as well as EDA, early data assessment, allows you to do all of this. For our purposes today, maybe we should call it EPA, early project assessment.
Early project assessment.
We're just trying to get more P's in there.
Yeah, we are. So
by the time this is over, we're all going to be laying on the floor drunk.
The one thing I'll add is that I find ECA super useful when I'm trying to gauge the cost benefit of litigating. So if you get an ECA and you pretty quickly can determine that it's going to cost, you know, $100,000 to review this case and the demand is for $100,000, you know, you just settle it, right? Like, don't go through the rigmarole of reviewing and spending all that money for nothing. So that's one thing I find them really useful for as well.
Now we have another P there. Proportionate. We didn't even talk about proportionate.
Oh, gosh.
I got a quick question, though, Andy. How important to you are running search terms during that ECA calling process?
Ooh, I feel like such a lawyer saying this, but it depends on the case. Like, I think there are a couple different lenses to look at this through. Like, if you're a corporation and you routinely see the same kind of litigation, and you know that it often hinges on specific issues, then running search terms just to really quickly assess your liability might be a really useful exercise. Similarly, if you're about to go into like a Rule 26 conference or some other negotiation and you want to know a little bit more about your data before going into it, or if you want to be prepared to talk about search terms that are way too overbroad or under-inclusive or both of those things, I think it's really helpful.
I think it's, if you want my opinion, she didn't ask for, but I'm good at giving my opinion anyway. I think it's vital to be able to use search terms to in that ECA process. And the reason why is just exactly what Angie said. This could very likely be the end of this matter. By the time that you go through the effort of, holy crap, we have data everywhere and the parties have agreed or are in the process of trying to agree on these groups of key terms. If I search this through my data sources, this is going to blow us out of the water. Screw it. We're just going to settle.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be very much end the whole process.
Let's talk about product now. Let's go to our final P.
Especially for all of us. We've all been around long enough to know there's about 1 million products on the market today. We like to do Brie math on the show. So when is the right time for us to use an e-discovery tool? Should we use an e-discovery tool for every single time that we review and analyze data? Or are there certain cases that really determine whether or not we use a tool?
Are you asking me, the product owner?
I am asking you.
Then my answer is going to be, absolutely, you need to use technology for every single use case. But in serious, in all seriousness, yes, you should be using some form of technology to address your e-discovery review needs, right? If nothing but for efficiency and risk avoidance. If you're not using some type of technology, you're at a lot of risk for manual errors, in my opinion. You don't have to use an end-to-end platform. Maybe it's just using something to redact information, but absolutely, you should be using some type of technology or product to address your review needs.
When we are using an e-discovery tool, what are the basic features that I need to make sure are there?
If we're talking just review, I can think of several key features from a review perspective, but I think it starts even before you get to that review. And you should consider how the data is being processed, because if you don't have the right tools for processing the information, that's going to be able to put that in a contextual manner, right? So let's take, for example, collection and processing of things like Teams or Slack or even mobile data, right? If you don't have the right tools to adequately, one, collect it in a, you know, a defensible manner, but two, process it so that when it comes into the review tool, you can see all that information and put it into some type of contextualized format to get the big picture is really key. Even before review, you need to have the right tools in place to collect and process it. As far as what I would expect. I personally think that having customization and flexibility to meet all of the different use cases for review is really key, because, you know, while you can have a review for a litigation as an organization, I may also have the need to do internal investigations, and I'm not going to go out and buy two different tools for that need, right? So I want to have a tool that can meet all of the different use cases for my anticipated needs. What are the key features there? You know, the ability to create multiple labels and customizable coding panels, very important. Search, also a key aspect, being able to not just do basic searching, but very advanced type searching, being able to easily redact information and have automated tools such as auto-redaction, right? Auto-labeling things based on in a bulk format, right? Or mass action. And I think AI or any type of assisted technology or to help you be more efficient is also really key. You know, visualizations, dashboards, and things of that nature. Yes, they're great and they bring efficiency, but I really think that some of the other things that I mentioned are probably even more important from a review perspective. Christy, what are your thoughts?
No matter what size the case, you definitely, you have to have a product, but it's got to make sense for the case, right? We definitely work with clients that have multiple products, because they want to use product one for a large scale case, but product two, you know, case two doesn't really need that sort of analytics and all the fancy bells and whistles. So they're going to just put it quickly into a smaller review tool. Big tool, big money. Little tool, little money. So that cost has to make sense for the type of case it is.
So I know we covered some of the bare bones necessities that we were looking for in our review platform. eDiscovery has been evolving, like we were talking about, for many, many years. There are more fancy schmancy and sophisticated ways that we can review our data. What are some of those? If we're looking to go all in and we want all the capabilities that we can possibly have today, Brenda, product lady, what are some of those advanced tools that are now available to us that people might not really realize of?
Actually, it has come a long way. I've been doing this, like I said, for over 30 years, and it has come an immensely long way. First and foremost, technology-assisted review is basically, I am going to identify a set of documents possibly or not, but I'm going to train the system on what is responsive or relevant to this review, and it's going to learn based on those decisions, and then it's going to feedback to me what the system has identified as also being relevant based on those prior coding decisions. I don't know why anyone who would do a review would not use some form of assisted review. Big or small, I think it fits the bill. It could be used for all case sizes. I know people out there would probably disagree with me, but why not let the tool or the technology do the work for you? Assisted review and having any type of AI that can help make that review more accurate and more efficient is number one for me. But there's all kinds of other technology out there as well. So foreign language documents, you know, being able to translate, having the technology to not only translate that document, but allowing you to search on that content of the document in either language is a fantastic feature. Automation that doesn't include the actual reviewing or analyzing of documents, but being able to automate the review batching process or automating the priv log creation and things of that nature. Like, there's so many advanced features that I could talk about that are super exciting to me. I'm the product lady. I geek out on all of the technology. I am really super excited about Gen AI and what that's going to bring to the review process, right? We here at Xtero have been, you know, we're working on technology that is going to me, it's mind-blowing when you ask it a question and it returns what you're looking for and gives you the documents to support it. Like, it is, I can't imagine a year from now where we're going to be with this type of technology, and it's super exciting. Compared to where I was 30 years ago, where they actually threw me in a room with rubber gloves and a face mask and the post-it notes that said, start reviewing documents, when I was fresh out of paralegal school, and I was like, first of all, what do you mean review documents?
So, Christy and Brenda, question for you two. What do you see trending in the world of review and analysis? And this can be anything, can be product, can be behavioral. Well, Brenda, I think you're going to want to talk Gen AI, I bet.
I was going to say the product lady here is going to talk about, you know, Gen AI and just any type of AI in general that's going to advance and change how we do review. That's what I see as trending. But I think that we're getting to the point where that first pass review is going to be done through AI. And then staffing review projects and things of that nature are going to significantly change. So technology is what's trending for me.
All right. Christy, what are your thoughts?
I would like to add on to what Brenda just said, but what do I see trending? It's going to definitely the Gen AI, but you got to realize that you're still dealing with lawyers that don't want to adopt technology. They don't trust the black box and what it means. I know of a couple of corporate clients that actually have policies in place that they cannot use Gen AI within, you know, the corporate structure. You know, that's where it's trending, but we have to know what does that mean for litigation, right? Because that's going to start building, like, what does that mean for, you know, mm-hmm. procedurally? How do they review it? What does it mean? But definitely the Gen AI.
Thanks for that. I am really excited to see where both of these things end up as well. No, where do you see the future of ESI protocols? And then what do you see in your alcohol future?
Two more questions.
First one, since I'll have water tonight. I would really, it's more of where I would like to see it, but I don't know if it's going to happen. I would really like to see judges really mandate protocols be put in place. That's what I would like to see. There's just too many cases without them, and that leads to discovery disputes. Not that there's not, but having a protocol in place is really what is going to help guide and put the guardrails on that discovery.
Yeah.
Right. So if judges are actually mandating them, then I think they're going to see a lot less discovery disputes. I've got clients that I work with now that they never used a protocol. And now that they've got a draft protocol, you know, a template, they're like, oh, this is pretty easy. I'm going to send it to my outside counsel. And that's what I'm going to have them use as the template. It's just getting with the right audience to say, here's your template. This is what you should use.
Yeah, I agree. I also think that you're going to see, because of the advancements in technology, going back to the product lady here, we are going to see a lot more technology related aspects in the ESI protocol. Maybe it's even explaining that black box so that the attorneys are more comfortable in using the technology. That's what I would like to see. I do agree with Christy that ESI protocols should be more widely adopted and enforced. Look at it as the party's prenuptial agreement, and it specifies who gets what when things go sour.
I personally think that there's going to be a demand for AI to assist with what we were talking about earlier, the finding the intent, finding the motive, finding the emotions behind the keyword hits. That's what I think. But who am I? And Brenda, are you working on that? It's on the roadmap.
sentiment analysis. We didn't really touch on that as part of the review, but absolutely that goes back to the very first question Angie asked. Why is review so expensive and what's impacting that? And that's just one of the other things, like sentimental analysis. And what the heck does this emoji even mean?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I have. Yeah. So think about, you know, that. That all goes into play too. So yeah, I agree.
Yeah, Bree. Right. I'm so glad you just said that, Bree, because there was a case. I actually posted it on LinkedIn that a judge ruled in favor of a plaintiff because the defendant gave him a thumbs up.
Yes.
I agree with you. So we definitely, that's really important when it comes to doing review.
It is.
Brenda and Christy, we cannot thank you enough for being here today and sharing your expertise. I know we just kind of scratched the surface of review and analysis, but we will have part two coming soon. But thank you guys so much for being here. Angie, I'll let you take us all out.
Yeah. All right. So thank you for listening to our podcast today. Please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tell your friends, family, and coworkers about us, but only the cool ones. And of course, feel free to reach out at any time on LinkedIn or at admin@ediscoverychicks.com with your questions, musings, or drink recommendations. Also accepting popsicle recommendations at this point, I think. All right, folks, thank you so much. We will see you next time.